McGrath. Now, 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And that music of Aaron Copland is from his ballet Rodeo, and Hoedown is part of the concert that is going to be presented by the Racine Symphony Orchestra on June 25th. And it will be a Lakeside Pops concert that also in large measure celebrates the 90th anniversary of the Racine Symphony Orchestra. I'm really pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Jonathan Winkle. And some of you may know that name because John Winkle has certainly done plenty of music making here in southeastern Wisconsin. Some of you may know John Winkle's father, Ken Winkle, who for many, many years was a member of the music faculty at Carthage, which is also John's alma mater. John Winkle is director of the Jazz Ensemble at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, music director of the Metropolitan Symphony, which is under the auspices of the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Program, and he is serving right now as interim executive director of the Racine Symphony. And joining us on today's morning show to talk about the symphony and about this Lakeside Pops concert, which is coming up on the 25th of June. John Winkle, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice as well. You've been on the morning show before, but it has been a little while. Before we talk about this Lakeside Pops concert, I think it would be right to just talk with you for a moment about what the last 14 or 15 months have been like for you. You and, of course, all professional musicians have had their lives really kind of upended by COVID-19. And all of the restrictions that it has necessitated. Can you just say a quick word about what this last year has been like for you, personally, professionally, musically speaking?
Well, in a lot of respects, it was initially a very devastating series of cancellations. And as you know, my wife is also a professional musician, and I can tell you that there was an 8-day stretch a year ago, March, where the next, 6 to 10 months of work was wiped out. And that was pretty challenging to kind of get one's mind wrapped around. And typically when you're freelancing in some capacity, you have, in a way, a lot of resilience built in, because if you lose one thing, you've lost one part of what you're doing rather than a single job that if something happens that has a more significant immediate effect. But, there were positives. I think that many of us sort of realized, with the slowing down of life in a way that was forced upon us, it forced one to perhaps reflect a little bit on sometimes people just stopped practicing, others really kind of hunkered down and prepared music that perhaps they hadn't had a chance to really work on. Because if you're always preparing the next program, it's sometimes difficult to practice things that sort of are on your stack of etude books or solo material that you want to get to, but you typically set aside. And so I think that for my wife and myself, the playing side of things was pretty difficult to lose work, and we're still not recovering. There are still things that are being postponed, even as some work is returning. It's very uneven. I was fortunate that the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee allowed the performance ensembles to continue to rehearse in person and concertize. Now, there were a lot of safety protocols that went along with that, so it was an interesting journey. But, you know, I was very, very grateful to be able to make music in some way with my undergraduate and graduate students at UWM. And of course, the high schoolers with MISO, similar set of circumstances, lots of safety protocols and different steps that were taken to allow for in-person rehearsing and initially some streamed concert performances versus having anybody in the room. So, on the whole, it was really difficult, Greg. I'm not going to candy coat it, but there were good things that came out of that experience as well.
Right. Well said. Tell us about the invitation that came to you to serve the Racine Symphony as their interim executive director.
Well, if for those of you that know my background, I've spent more than the last 20 plus years in arts administration. I continued performing professionally along the way, but working for a number of years at the Milwaukee Symphony, and then I ran the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra in Knoxville, Tennessee, and then I ran the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield, Wisconsin for close to a decade, and then I ran another presenting series in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So the arts administration track has been deeply rooted. Of course, I have a lot of relationships with people in southeastern Wisconsin, as you mentioned, and including in Racine and the Racine Symphony Orchestra. So there were a couple people that knew I had returned to Wisconsin from the work I was doing in New Mexico and knew that I was not in a full-time admin role and had just reached out to me to find out if I would be interested, willing to look at helping the Racine Symphony with Beth Bender's impending departure for another job. And I was in a position to help time-wise, and of course my interests are pretty strongly aligned with supporting live music performance. And in particular, orchestras occupy a really important role in my professional background. And the Racine Symphony, interestingly, was I think the first professional audition that I won. So I was a really young man. I was maybe 18, and won the principal trombone audition. And this is going back into the mid 80s. And so I played several seasons with the Racine Symphony, and most of the country's orchestras are like Racine's. They're not the New York Philharmonic or the Los Angeles Philharmonic or the Chicago Symphony. They're the Racine's and the Stevens Points and the Bloyd Janesvilles and Kenosha's and Manitowocs of the country. And I just feel very strongly that orchestras need the best level of care and support that they can obtain. And so I'm very motivated to do what I can to help the orchestra come out of the pandemic, which is, of course, a completely new experience for all of us. But I think we're positioned pretty well. And, the Racine Symphony is the oldest continuously running orchestra in the state of Wisconsin, which a lot of people don't realize. And we're coming up now on the 90th season, if you can believe it.
That really says a lot. I mean, and when you think about how the world has changed over the course of the past 90 years, for any organization to still be around and thriving really says a lot. So it's something for the Racine Symphony, of course, to be very, very much proud of. Can you just say a real quick word before we get to the concert, just talking about at least what you know of the symphony's efforts to remain vital and active during the restrictions of COVID-19?
Well, of course, this predated my direct involvement, but
right.
I was well aware of the streamed performances, albeit with smaller forces. You know, typically Pasquale Larino, the artistic director, conducting and or playing with a number of the other string players in the Racine Symphony. And I thought they did a really wonderful job of continuing to have some form of a presence through the season, even when in-person concertizing was not allowable or possible. And, you know, you saw a lot of experimenting going on around the country with, well, how do we do this? You know, I think, you know, the technology has been there for a while, but, you know, it's not a replacement for attending a concert in person, of course. And I think that there was a lot of steep learning curve climbing going on all over the world, not just in the U.S., but I think some of the streamed content will stay with us in some capacity. I'm not necessarily saying that a concert will be streamed, because we want people to obviously buy tickets and attend, but there may be opportunities to create another type of content, if you will, that is specifically designed for streaming. And so we'll see. You know, that's a little bit ahead of the curve right now. But I think that the Racine Symphony did a remarkably effective job at taking advantage of the existing technology and continued to have some sort of ability to reach out to its audience.
I quite agree. So the Lakeside Pops concert series, and it's a proud tradition of the Racine Symphony, resumes on the 25th of June with a concert that looks absolutely wonderful. And it will feature some exciting guests who will be on that stage. Tell our listeners about kind of the musical thematic content of that program, and the wonderful talented people that are going to be on that stage.
Sure, but I should clarify something, Greg. Because Festival Hall has been deemed off limits for RSO due to some renovation construction projects, this program and the August concert will be taking place at a new venue for us, which is the Fountain Banquet Hall, which is technically in Sturtevant, but on Highway 11, very easy to access. And when I started, we didn't even know if that this first concert was going to be possible. So one of the first things I had to do was evaluate, you know, the venue options that were available to us. And I think it's actually going to work very well for a pop mm-hmm. program.
Yeah.
So very, very similar type of format to Festival Hall, and which opened up, by the way, when I was in the Racine Symphony. So I was in the orchestra when those Pops concerts first began, which is rather fun for me.
Yeah.
But yes, the program, we have a guest conductor, Dr. Robert Tamaro, who's the music director of the Beloit Janesville Symphony Orchestra, and a fabulous guitarist and composer. And we have a wonderful violinist, vocalist, fiddler, if you want to go into some of the styles of music that he'll be playing, Joe Ketchum. Actually, Joe and I have known each other for quite a long time, and very versatile musician. So he's going to be featured doing some more bluegrass-oriented material mixed in with some straight-ahead classical music. And so things like Hoedown from Copland's Ballet Rodeo is a very, it's technically classical music, but it's obviously influenced very heavily by, you know, sort of common folk music that would have been danced to at Hoedowns. And so that's, you know, there's a lot of sort of high energy enjoyable music on this program. Thomas Aquino is a fabulous young classical guitarist, and he's I think he's working on his doctorate in performance at Indiana University right now, which is, as some of you may know, is one of the top music schools in the world. And so he's going to be doing some unaccompanied solo guitar. And of course, we have the big work on the program is Dvorak's Symphony No. 9 from the New World, and which of course has some loose influences from some of the contact that Dvorak had when he visited America with black spirituals, Native American music, and there are, you know, no exact quotations in the piece, but there are some influences, and if you go back to his letters, you can read about some of his comments about his very positive view of music that was being created by people in the U.S. Mm. And so it's a you know, pops programs generally tend to have sort of a really lovely journey emotionally and stylistically, and this program is no different. I think people have a great deal of fun listening to all these different pieces that that Rob Tomorrow has programmed.
It's a really great lineup. I am very, very impressed. Our listeners would probably appreciate getting at least a brief word on some of the precautions that are being taken in order to make sure that everyone can come and enjoy this concert in safety. So what are the protocols in place?
We are spacing. So all of the seating will be at round tables. So there's no concert row seating at all in this venue. But we'll have additional spacing between tables. So the physical distancing component of the safety protocols will be very much in force. We are at this time taking a fairly conservative approach to mask wearing. So entering the building, moving about in the building to go to restrooms, to buy a drink, leaving the building will require people to wear their masks. Once they're seated at their tables, they're permitted to remove them. We also are not having food service at this concert. We wanted to keep things as simple and straightforward as possible. So bar service only. So that's a bit of a change from, I know, the Pops concerts in the past. But we think that's just a simpler, safer way of sort of reigniting the Racine Symphony Orchestra season with in-person attendance. The orchestra, of course, will also be the musicians will be spaced further apart than would normally be the case. And so even though we're seeing some really great trajectories with declining positive cases, et cetera, we are still going to maintain some of the traditional safety protocols that we've all gotten used to over the last year or so. And so, you know, that is important. And of course, Heather at the office is handling most of those questions directly when people call in or email with any questions about that. And certainly if there are more concerns, people should feel very comfortable just asking how we're handling a specific situation if we've not made that clear on the website or in other correspondence.
Very good. And so if people are excited to attend the concert coming up, the Lakeside Pops concert on June 25th, what do they need to do?
Go to the website, racinesymphony.org, or they can call the office at 262-636-9285 and ask for Heather, because I will be of limited help. You know the old adage about a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Well, that would be in this case of processing a ticket order, that would be me. But Heather is in charge of handling all of our specific details, and she can really help people with you know, how's this setup going to look? Where should I sit? How far away will I be from the stage area? We do have two different price points. Not surprisingly, the more expensive seats are closer to the stage. But we think it's going to be a nice feel. And we have also added some more upscale bar selections. So if people want to have a little bit nicer quality glass of wine, that'll be available as well. So in lieu of food, we've tried to accommodate in some limited but creative ways.
I like that idea very, very much. So this Lakeside Pops concert again on June 25th, and this performance will be taking place at the Fountain Banquet Hall in Sturtevant, right on Highway 11. And again, you can go to RacineSymphony.org for more information on all that is going to be offered. Jonathan Winkle, the interim executive director, we will look forward to reconnecting with you a little later in the summer to find out about what's next for the Racine Symphony. But in the meantime, we appreciate you joining us today to talk about this upcoming Lakeside Pops concert. Best wishes to you and everyone associated with the Racine Symphony.
Thank you very much, Greg. Very much appreciate it.
And here are the closing moments of Dvorak's marvelous Symphony No. 9 in E minor. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, I am absolutely delighted to speak with Lauren Cochran, who is a senior fashion writer at The Guardian and someone whose work has appeared in Elle, Vogue, The Telegraph, writing on all matters related to the world of fashion. And we're going to be talking about a beautiful and fascinating book that she has written, which is called The Ten, The Stories Behind the Fashion Classics. In this fascinating book, Lauren Cochran examines the history of and the importance of 10 iconic items of clothing, beginning with something as basic as the white T-shirt, and finishing out with the trench coat, and in between, 8 other fashion staples. And this is a book that really examines these everyday staples of clothing, many of which most of us wear, some of us wear nearly on a daily basis. And it takes us behind the scenes and into the interesting stories behind each of these items of clothing. It's a wonderful book. It is such an interesting idea and beautifully executed. Again, the title is The Ten, The Stories Behind the Fashion Classics. And Lauren Cochran, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for your kind words.
Ahead of us talking about the book, can you just briefly tell us the genesis of your great interest in clothing and the world of fashion?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I have always been interested in fashion, not from a sort of runway point of view, as the book kind of illustrates, really. I've always been interested in how we use clothes as a form of self-expression. So I suppose that started when I was a teenager, as it does for most people, is when you're most sort of experimental with your clothes. And then as time went on, I became kind of really fascinated by that aspect of fashion, which I suppose is a slightly different point of view from a lot of my colleagues, I would say, who are more kind of from the kind of catwalk runway perspective. So that's kind of how I kind of came into fashion, slightly different route.
The distinction is made clear towards the very beginning of the book when you say this book is less about fashion and more about clothes. I've never stopped to think about exactly what the difference is between fashion and clothes. I mean, obviously there is overlap, but there is also, of course, a distinction that obviously means something to you. What is that distinction?
Well, I mean, I think it is to do with sort of fashion is an industry, isn't it? It's a kind of, you know, it's about newness. It's about kind of, you know, trends and kind of what's in and what's out. And I think the way that we wear clothes, that's part of how we wear clothes, but how we wear clothes is also a very individual, personal thing, isn't it? And sort of how you express yourself and how you're feeling that day is where I think how we use clothes. So how we get dressed versus, you know, a model on a catwalk, which is a very a vision of clothes, an idea of like sort of an ideal of clothes rather than how they're worn in the real world.
Hmm. You quote a number of people, although you yourself, of course, speak very capably and eloquently about the world of fashion and clothing. But I appreciated a quote from a novelist named Marlon James at one point who wrote, "Putting on external things can get you closer to the core of who you are." I think that really says something very intriguing there about how even though clothing is something that we wear in a sense on the outside, they are indeed external by their very nature, but that they express something about the internal side of who we are. And I'd never really stopped to think about that either. How is it that clothing serves that function in such a powerful way?
I think it's to do with the fact that it is, and the other kind of quote that I use in the introduction is Miuccia Prada, the designer of Prada, who says that fashion is an instant language. And I think it's partly that. It's the way that we sort of signal to the world how we're feeling without even opening our mouth. And also, and I think that changes per day. I mean, a lot of people have sort of things that they come back to and they wear all the time. But, you know, if you're, so for example, you're feeling a bit vulnerable, you might wear something completely different to if you're feeling in a very good mood and you're about to kind of, I don't know, go on a night out. You know, so it's about sort of signaling your feelings as well as, you know, other sort of things that clothes do, sort of like, you know, what you're doing that day and what the weather's like and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's that sort of part of it, obviously, but it also is to do with, like, how you feel. And they're able to do that in a way that I'm not sure people kind of give them credit for.
Towards the very beginning of the book, you mention a sort of informal game that you often like to play when you are out and about, and you call it outfit bingo. Explain to our listeners what outfit bingo is.
Oh, well, I would like to think that lots of people will now play this game along with me rather than it being just me. So what I tend to do, and part of the way that I sort of narrow down the list of the items that are in the book is if I'm people watching, which is a very favourite pastime of mine, I will count how many of the items I see on passers-by going by. So, for example, I'll count how many people are wearing jeans, and that's quite difficult because there are a lot of people wearing jeans. Or I might count how many people are wearing Breton tops. And where I live in Hackney, it's very much a sort of favoured item of that people wear a lot, so that one's quite easy. But and so you kind of get an idea of how popular these things are. It's quite interesting, and obviously they change on depending on what time of year it is, what the weather's like, what kind of, if it's a weekend, if it's a weekday. And it's kind of a fun way to kind of see, really see the sort of way that these items are just worn by everyone and of all sort of, you know, shapes, sizes, you know, ages, across demographic, these things are worn. And so I often play that game to kind of to see, you know, to take the temperature of each item at a particular moment in time.
Hmm. We're speaking with Lauren Cochran, and we're talking about her brand new book called The Ten, The Stories Behind the Fashion Classics. In this book, she tells us all about 10 of the most basic items of clothing that that many of us wear often on a nearly daily basis. And things as basic as the white T-shirt or the hooded sweatshirt or the little black dress, all the way to biker jackets and trench coats and much, much more. At one point in the introduction, you say that the pieces selected here, that is these 10, are unremarkable on purpose. And of course, it's really interesting to think about an author admitting that they're writing a book about unremarkable things. And yet there is often remarkable and intriguing history behind these otherwise unremarkable items of clothing. Can you tell us a little bit more about, in a sense, what makes these things unremarkable and then what you were able to find that is actually remarkable about them?
I suppose they're unremarkable because they are so sort of essential to most wardrobes. So you just don't think about them, do you? I mean, they're kind of like just there, you know. I mean, I don't know about you, but I probably pull on a pair of jeans 5 days out of seven. You don't think about, you know, where those jeans come from. But actually, they have an incredible history that kind of takes in everything from the gold rush to, you know, disco to racial profiling, to punk rock, and sort of everything else besides. I mean, it's kind of, it's so interesting how these items are kind of, part of the reason that I looked at them was because they have a sort of ubiquity across time, but they mean different things at different times. And so that's what makes them interesting. And I think that's also partly what makes them have that longevity, because they can kind of shift to something else, depending on their context.
How hard was it to actually choose these 10? You could have gone with less. You probably could have gone with more. Was it kind of a tough process to arrive finally at the 10 items of clothing that you celebrate in your book?
It was quite difficult. I mean, part of it, I did it by doing this sort of outfit bingo thing where I kind of like, so that helped me sort of distill down what people do wear every day. And then also I sort of looked into some stories like of things that people wear every day and found that actually their story wasn't as interesting as I thought it would be. So they were kind of, that was sometimes dismissed from that reason. Or something was too similar to something else. So, for example, I would have liked to have done the sweatshirt, but it's a bit similar to the hoodie, so I didn't do that. Or, for example, I would have really liked to have done the white trainer, but I think because I've already got two pairs of shoes in there, it sort of fell by the wayside. But, yeah, I mean, it was basically, I wanted to make it as relatable as possible and kind of go beyond the sort of idea of fashion being all about sort of ball gowns and, you know, that very glamorous idea and sort of think about, like we said before, about the about it being clothes rather than fashion. So that sort of principle helped me narrow it down.
I want to be sure to mention that each chapter, once you have explored that particular item of clothing, also includes a section on how to wear it now, and then also some bullet points summaries of the most important points explored in that particular chapter. But say a quick word about that section that is at the end of every chapter in which you talk about how to wear it now. I mean, we're obviously talking about really basic pieces of clothing. So what kind of assistance, in a sense, or advice are you giving in this part of the book?
I think it's about sort of, like in general, because obviously there's lots of ways that, you know, how you wear a breast on top now would be quite different to how you wear a little black dress, for example. But in general, I suppose the principle would be to kind of just relook at something that you think you know. and kind of think about a new way to wear it, or a kind of combination of something that is, that sort of changes your, you know, the kind of the safe option that you've done for sort of, you know, the five, 10 years or whatever. So say, say you wear, you might wear a Breton top with skinny jeans. I sort of say that actually try it with a kind of a pair of like wide leg jeans, or a kind of like, you know, a kind of army jacket or something, to kind of just a bit sort of like change it up a bit, you know, kind of. And I think now, the way we dress now, the way that things can kind of continue to be new, is through a kind of type of contrast. So sort of playing around with what you sort of, what you think looks, might look wrong at first, but actually looks right in the end. So you kind of, you don't go with the safe option. So, for example, with a little black dress, for example, you don't wear it with black heels. You wear it with a pair of, you know, like neon green heels, or, you know, sort of just to kind of give it a fresh coat of paint or something, the equivalent of that, is how I would say that you can kind of regenerate these fashion classics.
Mm. Let's talk about a couple of them. And the first one is indeed about as basic as one gets, the white T-shirt, described at one point as a sartorial humble brag, one that allows its wearer's uniqueness, their coolness, their charisma, their beauty to shine through. And I'd never stopped to think about that, but there really is some truth there, that when one is wearing a piece of clothing that draws incredible attention to itself because it's so spectacular, in a sense, the beauty or the handsomeness of the person wearing it could potentially get lost. But when all you're wearing is a basic white T-shirt, in a sense, people are really going to see you as well in a way that they not white otherwise. But describe to our listeners the way in which the white T-shirt has dramatically changed in its basic function over the course of the years.
Well, so originally the white T-shirt was basically underwear, and it has its own roots in sort of T-shaped items that were kind of underwear from sort of the medieval era. And the T-shirt, sort of as we know it, would have kind of come from around like the sort of 20s and 30s. It got adopted after that, after it became like a sort of staple for men really to wear under their shirts. It got adopted in the 50s by a kind of new generation of teenagers. I mean, I think partly because it for their parents it was seen as underwear, so it was a bit scandalous. Then it was worn by sort of people like, you know, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Elvis, Sidney Poitier. So it became a kind of mark of a sort of a new generation. And sort of over time, it became adopted by different demographics. So women started to wear them as a sort of fashion item in the 60s, really, with a kind of classic one would be Jean Seberg in Breathless, where she wears a New York Herald Tribune T-shirt. From then on, it became a kind of like, that's, I think, when it became a bit of a humble brag. Like you see sort of Jane Birkin in the 70s in a white T-shirt and nothing, you know, no makeup and just kind of jeans. And it's about kind of just sort of letting that beauty shine through. And that's still there today, I think. And you've also got the white T-shirt is also it's a sort of sandwich board. So it can kind of be the place where you sort of show your allegiance to a cause that you're passionate about, or a band you love, or, you know, anything like that. But it could also be, it's also part of a kind of newer fashion movement called normcore, which is very much about the sort of very much dressing in basics, and with people like Larry David as its icons. So yeah, I mean, it still lives on today. It's kind of it's worn by people who are very fashionable. It's worn by people who don't care about fashion. It's just become like a sort of it's got something for everyone. I'm actually wearing a white T-shirt today.
Very, very good. At one point, I loved the line that the white T-shirt is still indisputably cool. As a blank canvas, it is an arsenal of activism. Another staple of clothing that you explore in terms of its history is the miniskirt. And one of the things that surprised me was that there is some dispute over exactly who deserves credit for designing the first miniskirt. And I would have thought that something as iconic as the miniskirt would have a much clearer, cleaner history. Explain just a little bit about the mystery that surrounds the first miniskirt.
Well, so some of these items do have very clear history. So like the jeans, for example, very much can be dated to Levi's. But with the miniskirt, it's one of those ones that sort of like gradually happened, and then suddenly there was a sort of, a peak, and it became sort of an item of clothing that people talked about. So André Courrèges, the French designer, had skirts above the knee on his catwalk in some of his space age collections. John Bates, a London designer who isn't very well known now, also had short skirts. Saint Laurent did as well, and that was sort of all happened in the kind of late 50s, early 60s. What isn't disputable is that Mary Quant was the sort of like poster girl. She kind of became the sort of the icon of the miniskirt. And I write about this in the book, but she collected her OBE at Buckingham Palace in a miniskirt in 1966. So that is sort of like, photo evidence that she was the queen of the miniskirt, let's say.
Very, very good. I really appreciate the history that you give us of jeans and the story of Levi Strauss, although he does not deserve the credit for designing the first pair of jeans, but rather a largely forgotten man by the name of Jacob Davis. But it was nice to see that Mr. Strauss and Mr. Davis joined forces, and I assume both profited from this new design. Explain kind of the shifting role of jeans over the course of the years.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, they started out very much as a kind of like a item of clothing worn by, like labourers and cowboys and miners as part of the gold rush. And that was how they actually sort of became like a specific item rather than a pair of trousers made of denim. So that's where Jacob Davis saw the kind of gap in the market for these durable jeans. And from then, they kind of, they were very much associated with working men, really. And there is sort of evidence that working women wore them too, but they would have bought men's trousers. And then they sort of eventually became kind of acceptable for women from the 30s onwards, really. There was an advert in Vogue about Levi's, which was the so-called Lady Levi, as their first women's jeans were called. And then they became more, again, they were very much part of the sort of teenagers' uniform in the 50s. And as the kind of 50s and 60s went on, they became more acceptable for women. Marilyn Monroe in The Misfits was probably the first time that they were seen as a kind of like item for a sex symbol. And as time went on, they became worn by both men and women. And they kind of could sort of shift depending on the context. So you could have like sort of designer jeans as part of the sort of disco scene. So that's when like Calvin Klein and Fiorucci and Gloria Vanderbilt made jeans that were worn, to Studio 54. And then sort of in the 80s, they became the kind of jeans, the jeans that were fashionable were much more sort of downbeat and a bit stressed. Sort of, and that's when kind of vintage jeans started to become a kind of desirable item. And, you know, as sort of time went on, they different shapes and different styles have been adopted by different demographics. I talk about, in the book, I talk about the trend with lots of with African American teenagers for so-called sagging jeans, where they wear them so low that you can see the top of their underpants, and this became a kind of a type of racial profiling in the kind of early 2000s. And then at the same time as that was happening, they were the skinny jean was becoming kind of ubiquitous in kind of like more like rock and roll indie scenes with bands like The Strokes, who also took their inspiration from previous bands like The Ramones in the 70s. So they just, I mean, jeans just keep going. They say now that the skinny jean is on its way out because Gen Z are kind of sort of mimic, like they're sort of taking the mickey, that's a very vicious phrase, out of millennials for wearing skinny jeans, and they've kind of switched to very kind of baggy jeans. So, you know, they say the skinny jean is on its way out. I still think it's probably worn by a fair amount of people.
I thought one of the most interesting points made in this chapter is that that the first jeans, I mean, dating back to the 19th century, bear a remarkable resemblance to the jeans that we have today. I mean, some of these other items have probably changed a bit more over time, and certainly there's been some change in jeans, but but in many of the basic, in its most basic characteristics, not a whole lot has changed about jeans over the years, or at least not some of those really basic characteristics.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I guess that's why they're so kind of why they've lasted for so long, because, you know, it's a sort of it's a kind of no-brainer design that sort of like appeals to people generation after generation.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that in this chapter, among other things, you you tell us how actress Katharine Hepburn played a really crucial role in jeans becoming more and more acceptable for women to wear. And, of course, we take the story from there. And, of course, from the white T-shirt and the miniskirt and the jeans, we proceed to the ballet flat, the hoodie, the Breton, the stiletto, the biker jacket, the little black dress, and finally the trench coat. All examined in wonderful detail with all kinds of interesting photographs to help us understand these staples of fashion even better. The book again is titled The Ten, The Stories Behind the Fashion Classics, and its author, Lauren Cochran. Lauren Cochran, thank you so much for giving the world this really interesting book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure.
Oh, no, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you very much.
This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, two really interesting interviews, both of them from back in the 1990s. Tomorrow, Danny Newman, longtime press agent for the Lyric Opera of Chicago, from their first day of operation in 1954 to his retirement in 2001, with all kinds of wonderful stories from the world of the Lyric Opera of Chicago. On Sunday, my very first interview with longtime history professor Laura Gelat from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. On Monday, a much-discussed book Robert M. Smith suppressed confessions of a former New York Times Washington correspondent. It is Robert Smith's contention that the New York Times and other major newspapers, for that matter, are shirking their duty when it comes to just pure, simple journalism. And he believes, among other things, that the New York Times was unfair in its coverage of former President Donald Trump. You'll hear why on Monday's Morning Show. We remind you that the Morning Show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. The podcast version is available.